Spring has sprung. Are you spending more time with your favorite four-legged friends outside? Does opening day for the Reds have you ready to play ball with your dog, cat, or ferret? Are you thinking about bringing a bunny into your home this Easter? This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. On today's pet show, we have experts on animals of all shapes and sizes who are ready to answer your questions and offer tips. My guests are MedVet Cincinnati Emergency Department Veterinarian Dr. Angie Callahan. Welcome back, Dr. Callahan.
Hi, Lucy. Thanks for having me back.
MedVet Hilliard Avian and Exotics Specialty Leader Dr. Barbara Oglesby. Thanks for being here, Dr. Oglesby.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And Dog Abilities owner and trainer, Day Groton. Welcome back, Day.
Thanks so much for having me.
A note to our listeners, the advice you hear on this program is general in nature and should not substitute for a visit with your veterinarian. Do you have questions about your bird, bunny, or bearded dragon, or about your cat or dog? Give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Dr. Oglesby, let's start with rabbits. They're, of course, adorable. Are they difficult to take care of? What do people need to know if they're thinking about getting a bunny as a pet?
Well, most rabbits that we see now are, well, there's a saying that we have that the rabbit is the new cat. So they are more of a free-roaming house pet rather than what you might think of as a child's pet that's kept in a cage, a small cage, and not interacted with frequently. These have become really the family pet. And they do require quite a bit of care. Their diet is very unique and important. And they also tend to have some intestinal issues that become life-threatening pretty quickly in ways that you wouldn't notice in a dog or a cat. For instance, if they go a day without eating at all, even if they're acting normal, that can be fatal. And some of them will have chronic dental issues. So they're really much more of an investment in time. And I think it's just very different right now than it was back when I was a child, when they were considered more of just a child's pet.
Sure. I mean, I can remember when I was a kid and there would be people with rabbits that just stayed in these hutches in their backyards all the time when the weather was nice. Is it better for the rabbits to let them be these free roaming, you know, house pets, more like a cat or a dog?
Yeah, absolutely. They have as much personality and they are just as social as a dog or a cat. They want to be with you, or they want to be with their rabbit mate if they have a rabbit friend, and confining them to a small hutch would be really no different than confining a dog or a cat to a cage that could barely turn around and expect it to live its life that way.
Well, and rabbits, I know, are, you know, in the wild, they're kind of prey animals. Does that make them a bad idea for a small child? I mean, might they get scared of a rambunctious little kid? Are they better pets for adults?
Not necessarily as far as the prey part of it. A lot of children interact with their rabbit just like they would their dog or a cat, and rabbits can really be feisty and strike back. So as long as that rabbit considers you part of its family, it's generally going to be safe. I think the only real difficulty with children that might occur is in picking them up or handling them. Their backs tend to be really fragile, so they can cause some serious back injury if they're just carting around like they might a dog or a cat.
Yeah, that makes sense. You mentioned these intestinal issues that rabbits can have. Is it difficult to tell when a pet rabbit gets sick? I mean, I know it can be tricky even with cats. I'm a self-identified crazy cat lady, but is it tricky with rabbits especially?
Yes, it is even more so with rabbits. Excuse my French bulldogs here barking in the background. Yes, it's more so with rabbits because they are prey species. They do tend to act even to their family as if they're healthy, even if they're not. So what I was saying before about them not eating, if you had a dog or a cat and it just didn't want to eat that day or for, say, 8 hours that day, you wouldn't immediately think, oh, I better run it to the emergency room. But with rabbits, even if they're acting completely normal and they have and they've stopped eating completely, just won't accept anything, they usually have an intestinal obstruction or something else that's serious and actually can die within 8 to 12 hours. Oh. So that is, I think, the word that I try to get out most to rabbit owners, that even if they're acting fine, if they refuse all food and just stop passing any droppings, then that is an immediate emergency. Hmm.
Dale, what about introducing small animals like rabbits to other pets like dogs or cats people have at home? Are there tips for successful introductions? Have you had experience with that?
Yes. And with other animals, it does become a little bit more tricky. I do know a lot of owners that have rabbits that absolutely love their even large dogs. Yeah, like the Great Pyrenees and a particular rabbit mix that I can think of that are best friends. So it really is going to depend more on the predator, so the dog or the cat. If it's a high prey seeking species like some of the terriers, then it's generally not going to be a good idea. They really can't suppress that instinct to chase something like a rabbit. That is true also with things like ferrets. If you wanted to have a rabbit and a ferret together, that would never work because the ferret's instinct is to definitely hunt and, you know, ferreting out something, that term that you've heard, if you're going to ferret something out, that refers to sending a ferret down a rabbit hole to chase the rabbit out when they're hunting rabbits.
Oh,
so
wow.
Definitely don't want a ferret and a rabbit together. And cats, it kind of depends on the cat too. Again, how hard or how intense the cat's drive to hunt is. So it's a little bit more dependent on the predator, basically. Yeah. And even in bonding rabbits, there are places like up here in Columbus, we have the house rabbit rescue that actually has speed dating for rabbits. So if you wanted to adopt another rabbit, you can bring your rabbit in and just take them around to those that are available for adoption and see which ones they get along with. Because sometimes, whether it's two males or a male and a female or two females, it almost doesn't really matter. They often will just instantly bond or really, really dislike the other rabbits. So not sure exactly what's going on in their rabbit heads in that case. But yeah, they do tend to be pretty picky about what other rabbit they're going to bond with.
Yeah, certainly. People can be that way, too. So I get that. Well, we are talking about pets large and small for the full hour today. If you have questions, give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Day, I want to bring you into this conversation because I know you are an experienced dog trainer, and I understand you have had some success introducing bunnies and dogs and having them live in harmony. Can you tell us about your experience?
Yeah, sure. So I had a rabbit. She actually lived to be over 12 and a half years old, which is a pretty long life for a rabbit. She passed away a couple of years ago now. And at the time, and actually I still currently have these dogs, but I actually do live with terriers. So it is a little bit of an anomaly. As Dr. Oglesby said, that there are definitely some breeds that have a higher prey drive. And we definitely have to take that into account when we're trying to bring in another species into the home. Now, I will say, I think part of the reason why I had good success with my terriers and my rabbit was partly because they were pretty young. My Parson Russell was just a puppy at the time, and my Border Terrier was about 6.5 months old. I think it's easier when your dog, for example, is younger just because they tend to grow up with that other species. And so they look at them as part of the family, the group, you know, the pack, if we want to call it. And so by having them be a young age, you can really train them to learn things like self-control, impulse control, learning that the rabbit or the other species animal is not an animal that we want to chase, because that's something that definitely will get rabbits and other animals going. So we teach them, you know, to be able to learn to be calm, patient, all of those things. And both of my terriers, you know, they had a good amount of training. And I will say, it did not start from just where I'm like, here's the rabbit and here's the terrier.
Yeah, good luck, kids.
There was always management in place at the beginning. So things like I might have had my terriers in a crate at first, and they may have just seen my rabbit. And I wanted to develop positive associations with the rabbit in general. Eventually, then it moved to like a leash on them, and then eventually they could be out with the rabbit freely. She was not what we would call a completely free roaming rabbit. She had her own room, but she could come out at times when she wanted to. And she would come out into the living room area with all the dogs and just kind of hang out and just chill. I actually have a number of photos of them together, and my dogs would also do tricks with her. So I taught my bunny to do things like jumping and agility and things like that, and they would do that together. So they developed a really good relationship over time, and they just viewed her as part of being in our house. Now, with that caveat being said, that does not mean that if they saw an outside rabbit, that they would not chase that rabbit, because it was outside's just different
Sure.
versus inside. So we couldn't guarantee that in terms of that. But I think you definitely can, you know, depending all on the dog, because that's really the most important factor that we look at is the individual dog, that you can work on bringing in another species animal together, but you must have patience and time. I think a lot of people tend to rush it, and that's where we have problems. But at the same time, we always have to remember, you know, a dog is still or can be a predator. And that can even happen with dogs that have lived with their housemates for a long time.
Dr. Callahan, that whole idea of not rushing it, that seems like good advice when you're introducing any two new animals to each other, doesn't it? I mean, do you see problems in the med vet emergency room sometimes with people who have kind of rushed those introductions?
Absolutely, all the time. And even in situations where pets have lived together their entire lives, if one little thing just kind of sparks an altercation, we can see some minor scrapes and bumps all the way up to some pretty catastrophic injuries. So I see it a lot with pet sitting types of situations where friends will watch the other's dog or cat, and just not understanding that just because you're best friends with the human doesn't mean that, you know, the dog and the other dog are going to be really good friends. So it's definitely something to stay alert of and go slow, like Day said.
Yeah. Well, that sounds like important advice. We're going to continue our pet show after a short break. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're talking about pets, large and small, for the full hour today. My guests are MedVet Cincinnati Emergency Department Veterinarian Dr. Angie Callahan, MedVet Hilliard Avian and Exotics Specialty Leader Dr. Barbara Oglesby, and Dog Abilities Owner and Trainer Day Grodin. If you have questions for them, now is the time to call. Call 513-419-7100, or you can email talk at wvxu.org. We've been talking a lot about bunnies. Dr. Callahan, I want to move on to some of our bigger furry friends. It's spring, and that means fleas and ticks are more active. What's the best way to protect our dogs and cats from fleas and ticks?
There are many oral flea and tick preventives. There are still some topical flea and tick preventives out there. There are products that you can get directly from your veterinarian, as well as a lot of over-the-counter products. And I caution especially cat owners to the over-the-counter products and even some of the veterinary-only products because not all flea preventives are safe for cats. Some of them can be very dangerous for cats. The flea and tick powders, those are not as effective as a lot of the things that you can get directly from your veterinarians. There are holistic products available. I know some people will use like essential oils to repel fleas and ticks. Again, you have to be careful, especially with cats, because they tend to be a lot more sensitive with scents in certain situations. But the ones that are tested and proven are the ones that you're going to get from your veterinarian.
So even the over-the-counter remedies, Dr. Callahan, that say they're for cats, you said do people have to be careful about those?
So the ones that are most concerning are people will pull a product off of the shelf and not read the label carefully enough. Like those products that are for dogs, some people just inadvertently think that it's okay to put on a cat, and there are big black box label with a cat on the back with a big line going through it. So you just want to look all over that box to make sure that what you're getting is a safe product to put on a cat.
That makes sense. We did get a rabbit comment. A rabbit keeper out there says female rabbits should be spayed because it helps to prevent cancer. What are your thoughts on that, Dr. Oglesby?
Yes, absolutely. The most prominent or prevalent cancer that we see in rabbits is uterine cancer, and they have a higher rate of uterine cancer than other species like dogs and cats. It can be up to 70% will develop your uterine cancer by the time they're 4 or 5 years old. So we do recommend, highly recommend spaying them. As early as possible, or even if you adopt one that's older and 4 or 5 years old, the sooner we can spay and prevent that, the better. And I also actually wanted to make a comment on the fleas,
Sure.
if you don't mind. Just as you would have to be really more cautious in selecting a flea product for a cat, it's even more so in rabbits. For rabbits, they can get the same flea as a dog or a cat, and if they're all living in the same household, they can share those fleas. But you really have to get a rabbit-safe product, and there are some out there that are. You can get either over the counter or even from a veterinarian that are safe even for cats, but can be fatal for a rabbit. They're just really sensitive to those products. So make sure you check with your vet before applying any flea product on your pet rabbit.
That sounds like great advice. I mean, are there over-the-counter products that are labeled specifically for rabbits or other exotics, Dr. Oglesby?
No. Most of the time it's people just purchasing the dog and cat products and then putting them on their rabbit.
Oh, goodness. Okay.
Yeah.
We do have a caller on the line. Hi, Ginger. Thanks so much for calling. What's your question?
Hi, hello to everybody. I had a question about, I used to have a parakeet, and Johnny lived to be very old. His toenails got real long, and he'd almost fall off a swing. But I was thinking he just sang all the time. But I was wondering if I ever would get another parakeet at a young age, can you ever train them to talk?
Oh, that's a good question, Dr. Oglesby. What about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Of all the birds, pet birds, including big parrots, macaws, cockatoos, my absolute favorite are the little parakeets or budgerigars. And they can talk if you get them when they're very young, and especially if you get them from a breeder that has hand-raised them, so they're really bonded to the owner. They will talk. I had a parakeet named Joey for years, that his vocabulary was incredible, just sentences that we couldn't quite understand, but a lot of, hello, Joey, I love you, Joey, don't leave. So they absolutely can learn to talk. If you, again, primarily it's going to be that you get them at a young age and they're bonded more with the person than with other birds, where they're just going to mimic other birds rather than people.
Ah, okay. Well, thanks for your call, Ginger. I hope that helps. That'd be fun to teach a parakeet how to talk. My father-in-law had a parrot that the thing he did best was imitated the noise on the house alarm. When that boop, 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 that bird could make that sound. We thought somebody was coming in or setting the alarm all the time. We're talking about pets for the full hour today, everything from bunnies and birds to dogs and cats. If you have questions, give us a call at 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. I want to talk just a little bit more about the whole flea and tick problem. Dr. Callahan, if you find a tick on your dog or cat, what's the best way to remove it?
You want to make sure that you remove it to where you're getting the mouth parts out of the animal. And if you squeeze it the wrong way, you can actually introduce part of, you know, the tick's, you know, saliva or you know, other, you know, parts into the animal, and it can cause a local reaction or a systemic reaction. So if you see a tick, it's best to probably take it to your vet's office to help you get it out. I can't tell you how many times people will bring their pets in for suspected ticks and their masses or nipples or things that are supposed to be on the animal. So you know, if you do have a concern, take it to your vet so that your vet could potentially even submit it to the ODNR for identification, because I know they like to track tick species so that we can monitor certain diseases and spread of tick species around the country too.
Dr. Oglesby, do you ever see ticks on more exotic animals like rabbits and ferrets and that sort of thing?
Yes, absolutely we do, especially if they are outside, and a lot of them will go outside supervised, especially with the rabbits supervised. So we do see ticks on them. And well, in Ohio, we used to be a two-tick state, and now we are a six-tick state, just with climate change. And ticks that we used to only see in the South now have come to Ohio. And with those ticks have come the diseases that they carry. And it's important, as Dr. Callahan was saying, to have your veterinarian remove this. And in addition, just recently, Ohio State has a service where they will identify the tick if your veterinarian sends it in. And it also will identify any type of diseases that tick might be carrying. So if you had a concern, there was a tick on your animal or on you, and you send it in, and don't worry, that tick is not carrying Lyme's disease. So that can really help with not only worrying and keeping track of the types of diseases ticks carry in Ohio, but also just can be a peace of mind if you know that it's not carrying diseases that you're concerned about.
Sure. Dr. Callahan, we have a question from our own Marshall Verbsky, our talented technical director. He says, we are considering switching to oral rather than topical flea medications because their two cats like grooming each other so much. Are oral flea and tick medications as effective as topical? And what if they can't get their more picky eater cat to take the oral medication?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I know that there's oral flea preventions for dogs, and being an ER vet, my knowledge of the oral flea products for cats is a little bit limited. I know cats are tough to get them to take anything. It looks like we can get like NexGard and Credelio and some other ones, and I think trying to break it up into little pieces and hide it in things would be a way to try to get them into it, but it's going to be hard to get them to take anything orally. If they're you know, smart, you might be able to get it in once, and then getting it in some other times is, it might be a little bit challenging. I'm a big fan of hiding stuff in Braunschweiger because I have a cat that's difficult to medicate, and I can trick him 80% of the time with that. But, you know, having a cat that I put flea prevention on because he is an indoor-outdoor cat, I just try to keep him away from the other cats and my kids until it's dry. And then it's, you know, then it's pretty much safe to do. But I, other than the Braunschweiger trick, you know, or maybe like putting like a little bit of butter or coconut oil on it and breaking it up into small parts and pieces, you know, that would be my way of trying to get them to eat it, or hiding it in churu or something like that would be a way. I don't know if Dr. Oglesby has any tricks of trying to get them to take those big oral pills. I know sometimes the oral flea preventions can upset the stomachs too. So, you know, I think as long as you're getting that tablet into them over like, you know, a half hour period, I think, you know, they don't have to take all of it all at one time. But even, you know, just so that if they're given like a couple little treats in a short amount of time to try and get in, that might be a trick of getting it in to them as well. Hopefully that's helpful.
Yeah. Day, have you used any of your trainer magic to help get animals to take medication before?
Well, certainly. I mean, I think the easiest way, yes, it can be to put it in foods that the dog might like and things like that. I will say these days, or at least with some trainers, we are actually now teaching our dogs mostly to actually take medication. So there is kind of a process with that. But I have definitely seen people train it. And I think my dogs, honestly, would pretty much take anything because they're just really big food hounds, and I don't think they taste their food at all. But a couple things too. Sometimes we have some success with training our dogs to like catch, meaning like some dogs like to catch treats, and so sometimes we can, you know, throw a piece of treat, then throw the medication, then throw another treat. So sometimes that works. Sometimes we put it in, I've seen empty gel caps that we will put it in because it's just, they don't seem to smell it and taste it as much. So sometimes that has been proven to work as well. So in the end, like if they have to have their medication, it's kind of like you kind of just need to figure out a way to do it with the least amount of stress as you can. But if you do want to take the time to actually teach your dog to take medication, there's definitely training for that.
Yeah. And I know some people even have success training cats. So there is hope, Marshall. Well, Day, you were talking about stress, and we've had some upsetting and stressful news stories recently about dogs getting loose and sometimes biting or hurting people, attacking people. Does this start to become a more common problem as it gets warmer? What's your advice in terms of keeping dogs where they're supposed to be?
Yeah, I don't know if there's any correlation with warm weather. I feel like I see it year round in terms of seeing a lot of posts where dogs are loose in the neighborhood or get out of their yard or something like that. I think the key to it really is containing your pet. So things like if they have a fence, you want to keep them in the fenced area. If you have a fence jumper, you need to think about either, sometimes we put something like coyote rollers on top of the fencing so that if you have a dog who kind of jumps to the top and tries to climb over, basically those coyote rollers, which are PVC, it slides. And so the dogs can't get actually to, you know, catch themselves on top of the fence to hop over. Sometimes we do a double fence, you know, if you have that. I think you need to watch for things like gates and doors, make sure that they're secure as much as possible. You know, and I think owners just really kind of need to be aware as, and the reason why I say that is sometimes I will get clients who, you know, they'll kind of tell me, yeah, that dog gets loose in the neighborhood a lot. or that dog is always out and I don't know if there's a fence or not. In a couple cases, those dogs have definitely attacked either them or their dogs, which is very scary and can be very traumatic. And so sometimes I feel like some of those owners don't really know. They don't know that their dog is out. They're not watching or supervising. So I think that that's the biggest thing. I also think that if you are an owner and you have a dog who you know has some issues, meaning that you know maybe they don't like certain dogs, maybe they are wary of people, or they have a history of some reactivity and aggression, you definitely need to keep them contained somehow. I mean, that's mostly, you know, for public safety, but also for you, because that can certainly be a liability. And there have definitely been recently cases in the area where dogs were out in the neighborhood and they got loose. I think one case, a lady was trying to actually help the dog in terms of finding the owner, and the dog went and attacked her. So it can definitely happen. It's definitely super scary. But yeah, you need to be aware. Other things you might do, you know, maybe putting a tracker on your dog as well. So if you know that they are out, you can, you know, you can get them, you know, back home easily. There are some systems like ones that you can put on the collar, like the Fi is one, the Tractive is another one, Whistle. There's a bunch of apps that are GPS type that are based off of apps. And so they will notify you on the phone if your dog is out of range or whatnot. But it is a problem, and it is something that I do think we have to be aware of, and owners need to make sure that they are keeping an eye on their dog as much as possible, doing the management that you need.
Yeah. What about leash laws, Day? I mean, it seems like a lot of people kind of ignore those. Is it ever the right practice to walk a dog off leash?
I will say, like, in neighborhoods and things like that, I do not recommend walking your dog off leash, no matter how good your dog is at training. I mean, even with my dogs being pretty well trained and things like that, I don't walk them off leash in neighborhoods. Now, certainly there are some areas that are safe for dogs to be off leash and things like that. And so it is important that you definitely do, you know the leash laws in the area and that you do abide by them, because again, it's for your dog's safety and other people's safety. And we want to respect that, because not all dogs, you know, I mean, some dogs are perfectly fine walking on the street and things like that, but they would not like having an unknown dog coming up to them that is off leash. So it's important that we just, we're very cognizant of that and aware, and that we're respectful of other people, as well as keeping your dog safe.
And Day, do you have any advice for what people should do if a dog approaches them and seems aggressive? I mean, we talked about this on the program a couple weeks ago, and we had a dog warden who said, don't run, that's a bad idea to try to run from a dog.
Yeah, for sure, because that can definitely, running can, you know, elicit that chase instinct. So dogs can do that. I will say years and years ago, before I was even a trainer, really, but I did get attacked by two dogs. I was out actually on a country road, and one dog I had seen previously, another dog I didn't. And I will say, like, I don't know if I did all the right, I did not do all the right things. With one dog, I did, like, I did kind of approach and was very slow walking, things like that. And then I turned my back, and then that was when the dog, he like got me on my leg. So the other dog, I thought, had an invisible fence, and he came chasing, and he actually came out of the yard and he got me on a different leg. But anyhow, that was, like, we're talking like 20 years ago. It's quite a long ways ago. But yeah, I do think, yeah, I don't think chasing is certainly a good idea. Sometimes facing the dog and walking backwards can be better than turning your back. Sometimes it is good to carry something. In terms, we do have certain things like Direct Stop, which is a citronella based spray, and that it won't hurt the dog, but a lot of dogs don't tend to like that smell. So sometimes that can kind of ward them to just stay away. I will say a lot of times I do yell at the dog, like, you know, something like, go home.
Yeah, kind of be big and loud sort of, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. So sometimes carrying a big stick or an umbrella, you know, in case, you know, a dog was, so that way you have a safety barrier to kind of back the dogs away. I mean, it's good to learn some defensive handling techniques. The biggest thing you don't want to do is, like, especially if the dog does attack or something like that, and this is the hardest one, but you want to try very hard not to, like, get in there and grab, you know, a collar or something, or, you know, or try to grab the dogs, just because you yourself can really can get injured and bit. So you do have to be aware of that.
Yeah. Okay, well, we are going to be back with the final leg of our pet show after a short break. If you have questions, call 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're back with our pet show. My guests are MedVet Cincinnati Emergency Department Veterinarian Dr. Angie Callahan, MedVet Hilliard Avian and Exotics Specialty Leader Dr. Barbara Oglesby, and Dog Abilities Owner and Trainer Day Groden. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. And a reminder, the advice you hear on this program is general in nature and should not substitute for a visit with your veterinarian. Dr. Oglesby, we've been hearing a lot about bird flu. So many hens in Ohio have had to be euthanized in recent months because of bird flu. What's your advice for keeping backyard flocks safe?
Yeah, great question. And it is really unfortunate how it has really devastated our poultry, not only industry, but many of our backyard flocks as well. So the virus is carried primarily by migrating birds and waterfowl. And the safest thing really, as far as exposure directly from those birds, would be to have your flock contained indoors or with netting that would prevent the wild birds from entering. And if possible, having a procedure that you would disinfect your shoes and your clothing as you went in to feed the flock, and then again on exiting. And right now, at least at our practice at Hilliard, where we do see a really large percentage of backyard flocks and also waterfowl, like pet ducks as well, we're seeing them all in our isolation area. So, and actually, if they have any history or symptoms that would be suggestive of bird flu, then we, in some cases, aren't seeing them. But most of the time, our backyard chicken owners do have an indoor enclosure. And the best advice truly that I could give would be to have some sort of a netting or guard that would prevent any wild birds from entering.
I like how one of your French bulldogs is trying to kind of chime in and offer some advice, too. That's very helpful. Dr. Callahan, what about other pets? I know they can get sick from bird flu. I understand, actually, the current strain of bird flu is particularly bad for cats. Have you seen any of that in your practice at MedVet Cincinnati? What are some tips for keeping our cats and other pets safe?
Fortunately, we have not had any cases, confirmed cases of cats with avian flu. There are some upper respiratory panels that we can do if we have a suspected case. The ones that the cats that are associated with the infection have ingested raw milk from dairy cows. So I think if you have a dairy situation, you know, trying to prevent the cats from being exposed to raw milk. The other infectious source would be from eating raw foods. So raw food diets. If you have an indoor-outdoor cat that is a hunter and likes to hunt wild birds, that would also be a potential risk factor. So, you know, trying to keep those cats inside while this is happening, if at all possible, is a way to try to avoid that. But like I said, fortunately, we haven't had any suspicious cases at this point in our practice. So, you know, we've just been trying to talk to a lot of cat owners that, you know, are feeding raw to encourage them to, you know, get onto a product that's at least been pasteurized while we're trying to figure out this avian flu situation.
Yeah. Day, should we be more careful than ever to make sure our pets, our dogs, really stay away from dead animals that are out and about in the community, especially dead birds? Is that something you're really focused on with all this?
Yeah, I think that in general is good practice, honestly, especially while this, you know, avian flu is occurring. Certainly, I know some of friends that I know, especially who do hunting type tests with their dogs, like Labradors and other sporting breeds. They are certainly following the avian flu and keeping it, making sure that their dogs they're not supposed to ingest anyway, those birds. But just keeping track on what is happening. And if there's certain areas where there have been cases, you know, they have been avoiding those areas for sure.
Yeah. Well, I want to circle back to smaller animals, since we don't always have an expert on the show who can speak to those. Dr. Oglesby, we were talking about whether rabbits could be good pets for children. Which small animals are the most kid-friendly? Which do you not recommend for children? I mean, people always think of gerbils and hamsters and guinea pigs and that sort of thing. Are there types of animals that really are best for kids if you're looking in that direction?
Well, I think any animal can be a good pet for a child as long as they're well supervised and as long as it's not up solely to that or solely up to that child to care for the animal. So I think guinea pigs, for example, again, are often thought of as a child's pet and are often kept alone. And guinea pigs are really social and really like to be with other guinea pigs and can interact and really form a bond with their people too. So I think one thing that I hate to see is a guinea pig just kind of left alone in its little cage with just the child taking care of it. And is the same thing to some degree with some of the smaller rodents. They also can bite. So they may be cute and attractive initially, but then the child gets bitten or ends up neglecting the animal. So as long as there is good supervision and it really is more of a family pet than just up to the child to take care of, I think really any of them can be great pets.
Do people end up feeding their bunnies and parrots and mice and things just the totally wrong thing? We were talking about this this morning, and a friend said, "Gosh, I fed my mouse cheese because all the cartoons say mice love cheese, and that was ended up not being good for the mouse." Or are there certain things that you just shouldn't feed these little critters that some people do because they think they're doing the right thing?
Yes, absolutely. Especially for things like rabbits, guinea pigs, and chinchillas. Their intestinal tract is completely different. It's much more like a horse's than any other type of animal. And they need a lot of hay. They have to have a lot of roughage. And if they get too much carbohydrate, like some of those pet food rabbit diets that have not only the pellets in it, but lots of seeds and dried fruits and vegetables, those can be really bad for their intestinal tract. And if they suddenly eat a lot of high carbohydrate foods like cookies if they get into that, or the kid decides they want to feed them some Doritos, something like that, then they can suddenly get even a life-threatening intestinal state. So that I think is really important. And the same with the small rodents. There are commercial pelleted diets out there that are complete. They can tolerate treats a lot more than a guinea pig rabbit or chinchilla can, but you still have to be certain that they're getting a complete diet in addition to the treats. And also with birds, with pet birds, everyone thinks, oh, we feed them seeds. But honestly, if you feed your parrot or parakeet an all-seed diet, it would be the same as you eating an all-seed diet. Very limited in the nutrition, very high in fat. And we tend to see most of the disorders that we see in birds are related to being on all-seed diets.
Well, and with rabbits, I know some people like to feed them dandelions or grass from the yard, but I guess you have to be pretty careful that there's not some kind of insecticide or herbicide on that, right?
Yes, absolutely. They do like dandelions. So if they don't have any herbicide, it's fine to feed that. But again, just as a treat, the staple of their diet, at least 90% of it, should just be a good quality hay and the rabbit pellets, and then things like dandelions and other treats that you can buy commercially, or little pieces of carrots. You think bunny and carrots, they should really just be limited to a little baby carrot every day. And the greens really vary. The darker green in color, the darker the color of green, the better for them. And they need to be introduced sort of slowly, so the rabbit's intestinal tract can accommodate and get used to it.
Okay. Well, I've been talking with MedVet Cincinnati Emergency Department Veterinarian Dr. Angie Callahan, MedVet Hilliard Avian and Exotics Specialty Leader Dr. Barbara Oglesby, and Dog Abilities owner and trainer Day Groden. Thank you all so much for your time today. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Thanks so much for listening.